The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
It's Cascadia News Now. I am Stephanie Contouris with Dave Willingham and Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson. If you are listening to this, you are listening to it at some point during the Martin Luther King Day weekend. I want to remind you at what point we are during the weekend that it is more than just a day off, that Martin Luther King is and was a great man. And I hope that you take a moment to either be involved in the Bellingham event on Monday, or we're going to be talking a little bit more with Barbara Rothgar about what's coming up with the Whatcom Human Rights Task Force's event out at Whatcom Community College on Saturday. But man, I just have to opine that human rights more important this year than ever.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope that the circumstances lead people to get a little beyond the usual had a dream, went to the mountaintop, cruelly murdered story. There's a lot to the story of Martin Luther King Jr., and it really was a fascinating person.
Yeah, and I guess this is we always mark things in terms of anniversaries, 10, 25. This is actually the 50th year of his assassination. And so it has a special sort of resonance. 2018 is the anniversary of a lot of unfortunate things. It's also the anniversary of the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. So I think people should have it in their minds that, to be mindful of these civil rights champions.
And not just those that we've lost. You know, this is an opportunity to remember people like John Lewis, and we keep losing the men and women who were there. You know, we just lost Dick Gregory a few months ago, and, you know, we're not going to have them forever, and it's important to, you know, learn from them and, get what we can from them.
Absolutely. Barbara Rothgar, many people know, is a longtime and an honored award-winning activist in Whatcom County. And we will be talking to her later in the show about Martin Luther King Day and the Human Rights Task Force. We've also got an interview coming up about the push for fiber optics, public fiber optics in Bellingham. But first, There should be a stock market-like bell for the beginning of the Washington legislative session for those of us wonks who, you know, would salivate or are already salivating because it started. And in the past few days, we have heard a lot from Senator Kevin Renker, who represents South Whatcom County and south of here. And we have a state of the state from our own Governor Inslee. And Dave, what did you take from that?
The governor has his agenda, and, you know, he was really pushing hard for his version of a carbon tax again. This is, you know, at least the third time he has brought it up in a state of the state. And the proposal this year is a little more fleshed out than previous. They're looking at $20 per metric ton of emitted carbon, which is slightly less than the initiative that failed a couple of years ago. And he's going to be working that throughout the session. Also talked about.
Before we go on from the carbon tax, wonks know and have been fighting, and I've seen already people rising up against it or championing it. What, theoretically, how would a carbon tax play out for the average Washingtonian?
For the average Washingtonian, a couple of things will get more expensive. Electricity generated by legacy systems will be more expensive, and fuel prices will go up. The theory is that, like most, you know, sin taxes, we're taxing something that we don't want more of. And by putting this in place and the way the governor has structured his plan, it would increase the tax by, I believe, 3.5% a year after it goes into effect in 2019. And a good, like half the money would go towards clean energy projects. There would be, you know, some distributed towards lands preservation and education. And it really is a way of trying to step up. We just had the most expensive year for disasters on record in the United States. And it's a way to try and do something about this.
And high in Washington State also with our own fires.
Well, you know, two things about this. One is that when Governor Inslee was giving his State of the State and talking about this, my email board was lighting up from environmental groups. I was getting messages from environmental groups all over the place, all over the state, expressing their excitement about it, because I think the environmental groups believe that this is the right path, because in the past, one of the things that it was just set up as a, you know, maybe a cash cow or something like that. But the revenues from this proposal will be put back into communities and neighborhoods at risk that suffer from environmental pollution. So there's that social component that had been missing, I think, from other ones that got those groups, you know, excited about the proposal. And I think that the other thing that you have to realize is that there is, in the Senate right now, a proposal to make Washington State basically carbon neutral that's energy sources are not from carbon polluting sources. So we will have shut down coal plants and and those electrical generation. And also an electric vehicle mandate, basically with a target of 2048. So you're right, Dave, that this will cause consumer prices to go up. But in the long term, the entire package will basically get Washington State off that grid and normalize those costs over time.
Yeah, and you mentioned the email thing. There's something really to that. Obviously, in this case, the governor worked with environmental groups ahead of time. That was the big criticism of the initiative a couple of years ago, was that it was put together by a group that didn't interact a lot with other groups who had other priorities. In this case, the governor's been working very hard to bring everybody to the table and to coordinate a plan.
Come on, Dave, name names. Name names. You're speaking around the names.
I don't have to. Everyone is talking about them. If you look at the governor's own write-up of his plan, he lists the groups that he's working with. Any group that is involved is talking about it on their website. It's not a secret.
So last time, if I recall correctly, it wasn't just that some environmental groups were opposed to the carbon tax, but labor groups and immigrant rights groups were opposed too, which made it, I think, one of the most agonizing decisions for voters in at least my history in Washington State several decades.
Right. Well, you know, as Senator Ranker explained it to me, it blew a gigantic hole in the budget, too. It was supposed to be revenue neutral, but actually it ended up with a cost. And so he you know, how can you support something that does not achieve the sorts of social progressive goals that you want and also creates more hardship in the state budget? So that initiative that came to voters a few years ago, that was something probably rightly put down. And it went down in the right way. It went down by a very close vote, which meant that there is public support for this kind of thing. It just has to be put together in the right way.
Yeah, and this proposal really goes, like Tim was saying, to help areas that will be especially hard hit by the increased taxes and places that are already hurting because of environmental issues. And, you know, we're not like California. We don't have oil derricks in poor neighborhoods here in Washington State, but we would if we could. And, you know, wherever you are, it's the poorest section of your community that faces the worst environmental conditions.
Okay. Carbon tax love fest here. It's great. We have a lot of sin taxes in our state. And what I have already been hearing is, in terms of the pushback, oh my God, not another sin tax. We're taxed enough.
Well, I guess what I would say is this is targeted to the polluters, but, you know, obviously they will push the costs onto the consumer. That's the reality. And I don't think there's any way to approach this that something like that's not going to happen. In other words, if you try to tax the major polluters in the state to get them to pollute less, which is, the term for this is a tax shift. If you try to do a tax shift on them, they will figure out some way to force those costs back out onto the consumer. That's just the capitalist system we live in. I don't know that there's we can grouse about it, but I don't know that there's any solution to
Washington
it.
State income tax. That's time. Another discussion. It's a short session. It's not going to happen this time.
Or a capital gains tax might do that too.
Right.
Well, and you know, we allow risky businesses like fossil fuel industry at community peril. When there is a disaster, it is not solely the responsibility of the people who caused that disaster or whose behavior made that disaster likely. And that is a failing of our system, but it's pretty deeply ingrained. So I think this is a middle ground. If something is harmful, you should get a little bit more money out of them.
And speaking of disasters, you might remember last year there was an enormous salmon disaster when Cook Aquaculture Net broke open and Atlantic salmon spilled out in the hundreds of thousands all up and down our coast into Vancouver waters and Victoria. And Senator Kevin Ranker is speaking to a bill that will ban future commercial net pens used for fish farming in Washington state. That's going to be another thing to watch. And he also spoke to the carbon tax, I believe, and has put forward a whole agenda. I know you spoke with him, Tim. Do you want to give us quick recap?
I did, and he's very excited because, you know, I don't know if Republicans feel the same way about things that Democrats do, but when you have an opportunity to get some things done, you have a little window to you get kind of excited because you've been paralyzed for years, and now, I mean, you signed up to do things, and so now you have an opportunity to do some things. So he was very excited when I spoke to him. I would call what he's trying to do with aquaculture in Washington state, I'd call it a sunset rather than a ban, because he realizes that these companies, they have contracts, they have leases, and if you just said, I'm sorry, you're out of business today, you're going to get sued. So this would be a sunset of these things which cause harm to Puget Sound because there are biohazards, there are food wastes, these fish carry parasites. On and on and on. And if you have a mandate to clean and restore Puget Sound, this industry is at odds with that, that initiative. So the aquaculture thing is part of something that he's very excited about. He's very interested in the climate package that the state's into. And then he's also sponsoring some things that are very specific to Salish Sea.
And he is one of our most vocal state representatives, and we are very fortunate that we are going to hear from him ourselves next week. So be sure to tune in whatever time you listen to Cascadia News Now. Tune in next week. Okay, just a couple of minutes more. What else are we looking at? What's popped up?
Okay, so the Associated Press and a bunch of Washington newspapers sued the state legislature because they refused to turn over documents. And they cited changes to the Washington State Public Records Act that they said exempted them from having to do so. And a bill has been put forward, Senate Bill 6139, that would explicitly say, no, the legislature is subject to the same rules as the executive and judicial branches. But our very own state attorney general filed a brief in the case stating flatly that the legislature is bound by the same rules as the other branches. And so that bill might not have to go anywhere. The legislature was very unhappy, and rightly so because the state attorney general does represent the legislature in legal matters if they request it, but they didn't request it until yesterday while the case had been going on for some time. So that was kind of fun.
Right. And the other thing that I think we have to talk about is the measures that the Republicans are putting forward. And one of their things, and I know, Dave, you'll have something to say about this, but our own Vincent Bies and Luann Van Werven put forward, they were part of a sponsor of a bill that would basically try to walk back some of the impacts of the levy shift, they were the ones that proposed as the solution to McCleary. And I would like to hear what you have to say about that, because I don't expect it's going to be great.
It's not great. I mean, they basically took the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, put forward a proposal a couple of weeks ago that said essentially the same thing. And some people in the legislature decided to put their name on it and say, oh, here's our idea. And I will have more on that soon. Right now, we're going to go to Stephanie interviewing Barbara Rothgar of the Whatcom Human Rights Task Force about the MLK conference over the weekend.
It's a year where things are changing in our country. The moral fabric of our country is being questioned. There appears to be everything Dr. King talked about, the militarism, the materialism, et cetera, seems to be going strong. And our community citizens are being left behind.
Do you want to get a little bit more deep on that or give me a couple of examples?
Well, the Congress passed, well, the president asked for a very large increased military budget. Congress gave him even more than he asked for. And they continue then to go on and cut taxes for the wealthiest. And our children, our grandchildren, will be put in $1.5 trillion of debt by the next decade. So that, to me, has nothing to do with the well-being of our country, our citizens, etc.
And something was just released this past week about people who had been granted temporary immunity or temporary citizenship, that it seems like it's having huge repercussions in human rights communities.
Absolutely. The Haitian community, the El Salvadorian community, all of these people were given some relief when trauma occurred in their countries. And now we're saying, go home. The DACA students, I mean, some of them have been here when they were months old, and now we're telling them they can't stay. Those students are American. They're students who came over with their parents, and they may have, the parents may have come over illegally, but at this point, these kids are students. They're citizens of the United States. I've had students in my class who said, you have no idea how you can't raise your voice, how you can't be seen. I think that is changing. I know the students are becoming much more active about saying, wait a minute, they don't even have an accent. They're much more American and understand what the United States is supposed to be about than some of our students whose parents have been here maybe for a couple of more generations.
So here we are in this situation where if you care about human rights at all, things seem really rocky and people are being attacked from all different levels. And this MLK conference, which happens every year, how does it help people arm themselves or take action in a situation where a lot of people feel helpless?
I think the issue and what Dr. King wanted more than anything was to educate people on what it's like to not be in the forefront of opportunity. And so what the conference tries to do is give people information, arm them with some understanding so that they can go about making the changes that they feel are important to make our nation strong. And we cannot possibly be strong leaving people behind, not educating, not allowing people to claim their identity and their belief system in a way that allows them to incorporate with others in this nation.
So say I'm walking in and I'm just a white person who isn't connected. I'm a straight, white, cisgendered person. What might I be like, or what might be different for me walking out of this conference?
Hopefully you'll have grown in understanding of how people have struggled. Hopefully you will understand your part in that struggle, how accepting the way things are allows us just to continue not seeing what needs to be seen to make the changes, to make the country strong, successful, healthy, you know, those sorts of things. I think that you will, you'll, if you're open to learning, you can learn a lot in this conference.
Barbara, there. Some people might be hearing this, and the conference has already happened. So we'll, let's talk about how we can continue that work. But one thing I want to latch on to what you said is accepting where we are in order to change. I don't want to accept where we are, and I'm not the only person who looks at the world and looks at our government and says, I don't want this, I don't like this, and I don't want to accept it.
So in that way, if you don't want to accept it, part of what's happening is people are stymied for trying to figure out where they go next. I think one of the things the conference does is give you some understanding. There are a lot of people out there who realize what is going on is not right, is not normal, is not natural for humanity to survive. And that connection gives us hope. And I think we can't move forward without any hope. We have to envision a future that we believed in, the freedoms that we thought were available to us are not available to everybody.
I hear that. And obviously, if you listen to our show, you know that there are people who do not have the same opportunities now. There are huge injustices now. I know this conference did not or could not change that. Obviously, MLK conference once a year is not enough to affect change. What happens now?
There are things happening in Bellingham right now. There are a number of different groups that are trying to organize. There is a city MLK, and Trula will be talking.
Trula Nickel.
That's it. It's at Mount Baker Theater, and Colchin Chorus sings. It also connects you to people who understand what Dr. King was talking about and why this is so important we come together as community. And which was what Dr. King wanted, you know, more than anything. One of the things I do want to talk about with the conference, and I know that some people will have missed this, is that we do have a group of women of color who will be doing our keynote. And these are all people who live in our community. So they're going to make a contribution to our community by explaining to people what it's been like for them and the experiences that they've had. Whereas some of us may not have ever run into anything or have seen it. When I think these folks will talk, one of the things that's going to happen is our awareness is raised, and we can start seeing things that maybe we bypassed or didn't pay attention to in the past that happen right in front of us, and we then learn how to make changes. We change the situation, whatever's going on at that moment.
And you'd have to be under a rock at this point not to know about the rampant sexism in every single profession, not just Hollywood, but every single profession has rampant sexism, and places where women are attacked, women of color are even more shut down and shut out in day-to-day existence. So it sounds like having a fishbowl experience where a group of women of color is talking and everybody else remains silent is a good way to kind of challenge that balance of power.
Yes. And then the women are very open to taking questions from the audience after that. So it will be somewhat of a dialogue after their initial experiences and their own expression of what is going on. And so I think that dialogue is what's really important also.
You were talking about hope, and we're talking about a group of women of color speaking and giving people the opportunity to be silent and actually listen, which is powerful. We're very close to the anniversary of the gigantic National Women's March, however you pronounce that. And a lot of people felt that hope that you're talking about, Barbara Rothgar. And yet people went back to work and or didn't work, depending on their situation, or were not able to find work, or were not able to find housing. How do you maybe not maintain that level of hope, but how do you kind of capitalize on, once people feel that hope, turning it into action after the conference?
I think that I guess I'm looking at it as once you learn and see people who are really just like us and some of the things that they have done, then it makes you realize you can pick up the phone, you can call a senator, you can call a representative, you can write a letter, you can write a letter to the editor, you can do things, you can march. I just read a letter recently where someone was talking about Iran and their economic system and how many of the young people have not got work, and they're out on the streets. You know, when does Bellingham go out on the streets? And we did last year. We did go out on the streets. And I think the nation as a whole needs to understand that we are not here for the 1%, that we are here for all of us. And the question is, how did they get so wealthy? How did they take everything so that people are paid and have to live on tips or what have you to survive? That makes no sense. And it is not that they've worked harder. They've been privileged, and they don't see that privilege, unfortunately. And it's maybe us that needs to see the privilege and strike out to kind of show them how what that privilege has meant and how they need to become part of our community.
That itself is powerful and hopeful. What organizations could people connect with, or how can people connect, especially if they missed the conference?
Well, there's Whatcom Peace and Justice Center. There's our Human Rights Task Force. There is Indivisible is another one. There are any number of organizations. And actually, we will have many tables at the conference of nonprofits that will be giving information out. So there'll be jobs for justice. Housing is a big issue.
Bellingham Tenants Union, maybe.
Right.
Bellingham
right,
Racial
yes.
Justice Coalition.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. All of those will have tables at the conference where you can get information, you can become a part of what they are doing, and feel empowered just by being with community.
And I know the Human Rights Task Force, which, full disclosure, I used to be on the steering committee decades ago, they had sort of shrunk as an organization for several years. And really, the MLK conference was the one big thing that they focused on. Yeah. But now things are changing with the Human Rights Task Force.
Yes. You know, with the invasion of Iraq, you started to understand that what was happening, where we were spending our money and how we were dealing with people overseas, we actually didn't realize we're dealing with them the same way here. And so I think what's happened over time is we combined with the Whatcom Peace and Justice Center because we felt our issues were very similar, whether they're in a foreign country or whether they're here. And with the election, this last election, and I have to say, I think with Obama, people felt like there would be changes, and yet those changes did not occur. There wasn't a reduction in the military. That money did not come back to education, to health care, to our infrastructure, et cetera. All of those things, I think many people felt were possible, did not happen. Therefore, I think that what's happened is that people realize they have to stand up. If there is ever going to be change, we actually have to stand up.
Absolutely.
Yes.
What kinds of things? Can you give us a hint as to what to expect from the Peace and Justice, Human Rights Task Force in the future?
Well, we, one, hope to do films, hope to do a book club. We have an intercultural dinners that a group are working on to try to bring different community groups together and learn more about each other. We're talking about having some folks come up and maybe do a workshop or a lecture on things that are going on, whether we get them from Seattle or Vancouver, et cetera. Just so people will have an understanding. The other thing I want to just say real quickly is that Bellingham Human Rights Film Festival is the last 2 weeks of February, and their films are all free. They're all about human rights around the world and in the United States, and they're in different locations, so you can. And they usually have a speaker that can help people understand maybe what they can do, if they have questions about the film, etc. It's another wonderful way to be part of the global community in a positive way.
So maybe you'll come back and tell us a little bit more about that coming up in February. Barbara Rothgar, thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you for asking me.
You are listening to KMRE 102.3 FM Bellingham and 102.5 KAVZ in Deming and Van Zandt, Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris with Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham, and quite a lot going on the more local level this week, starting with the brouhaha over round two, Senator Doug Erickson 2.0. Is he going to be with the EPA or not? The Bellingham Herald announced that he had taken a job with the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, in the Seattle office, and then unannounced it. And it sounds like there was some behind-the-scenes rambling and maybe some deal-making and deal-breaking. And what I had heard is that somebody actually called the number that was released to be his phone number, this is anecdotal, at the Seattle office of the Environmental Protection Agency, and the phone outgoing message said, "Doug Erickson is not in," which I have a hard time believing would have been recorded if he had said no at the first ask.
Yeah, it's a curious story, and I think there's more to be gleaned about it at this point. But yes, I think that I think Walker Ornstein of Associated Press called that number, got a voicemail message for Doug Erickson, which is at EPA, which is Region 10, which is a little odd if he had not accepted
a position at one point.
A position, and I could speculate. I'll let other people weigh in before I speculate, but I think that there's probably an explanation, but it's completely speculative at this point.
You've let in.
Well, I guess what I think happened is I think that a job was offered to Senator Erickson, and it wasn't the job that he wanted, and he might have been in the middle of negotiations on that when some great citizen activists, Sandra Robson, for example, started poking around to see if he'd actually had accepted a job with EPA, and then he got kind of caught in this transitionary thing where I can neither confirm nor deny that, and that's essentially what he told Bellingham Herald, I think, and they were put in this position of, well, we're going to go with the story unless you deny the story, and it's like, well, I can't confirm or deny that story. Then he said, well, I'll issue a press release on Monday. That was this Monday.
And that implies?
That implied he had a statement to make. Yep. He did not issue a press release on Monday, and that got the Seattle Times annoyed because mm-hmm. It's like, if you say you're going to issue a press release, you actually should issue one. And that it started to spiral, and suddenly something that might have just been a little local dust-up suddenly became a statewide issue, and the Seattle Times was reporting on it. Spokane Review, Spokesman Review was reporting on it. The Stranger in Seattle reported on it, and it just became, I think, a big mess. And I think what happened is, I think Senator Erickson got his hand caught in the cookie jar in transit.
And, you know, I don't understand why he wouldn't want a job at the EPA. It's almost certainly got to pay more than state senator.
And that's the rumor. Yeah. Like maybe even three times as much.
Well, I guess I can address that. The position that he apparently had been offered was as an advisor, but the rumor that's gone around for months and months was that the job that he really wanted was to be the director of Region 10. And being a director and being an advisor are two really radically different things. And I would say that being a director – I'm just going to speak sympathetically to Senator Erickson for a moment. When you're the director of something, you have some job security. If you're an advisor, you can be released from that position. And so you have to make a decision. I'm a senator now. I'd love to be a director. Do I want to be an advisor?
Well, that's certainly more generous than my assumption that there's a lot of power and prestige concerns with certain office holders that we have in the county. And I'm not inside his brain, so I'm really glad that you put up that alternative speculation. In any case, some people have put out the question that maybe this isn't over and that negotiations are still happening. It's really interesting considering all of the brouhaha that happened when he held two jobs during the transition government of the Trump government and was working full time for the EPA while he was collecting full time salary for being our senator. And I think that there's still a lot of hard feeling about that. So maybe that's partly why some of our intrepid local activists and journalists had their hackles up pretty quickly.
Right. And I'll just give you – this story will unfold. I think the thing that you'll see coming out next is people are going to be doing some federal records requests on – because, you know, if an offer was made, then it's probably in writing. And I think that you'll see this story will continue to trickle out and unfold a little bit as some of these records requests come forward and we get more information. You know, unless Senator Erickson just wants to – disclose that information, in which case it could be over right away.
Where would the fun be in that?
And that's why we have a radio show, folks, for fun and speculation and, as Tim likes to say, bloviating. Look it up. I did. Anyway, so going to the county level, this may be a little bit on the wonk side, but the Whatcom County Council had a special meeting to determine who was going to be appointed in the absence that is created by Todd Donovan moving from one seat to another seat. And we have speculated earlier on a different version of the show. We talked about who we liked. I wanted to say congratulations, Tim, because I know Tim Ballew got 5 votes and he got the most votes in the first round.
He did.
And hopefully that means that he is a strong contender. Some people were pretty irritated because our newest county council person, Tyler Byrd, suggested Pete Kremen's name, and I think you had actually said, Tim, didn't you even bring up Pete's name at one point?
I said that he would be somebody that you might appoint to fill that position because he knows the position. And I mean, he's a lot like, although I don't think he shares the same values, but he's a lot like Seth Fleetwood, who put his name forward. He's somebody that has held the position, that doesn't want the position in the future, but is willing to, well, I don't know if he's willing, but reportedly, he would be willing to do that position through the November election. I guess what I would say about this is just a little background. Council had put in, they had announced for applications, and they got 29 applications. One person withdrew, so they had 28 applications. How do you pare down 28 applications? So the method that they used was each council person would put in 3 names. And then they would count them up, and they would begin to see that there was some consensus building around certain names. Then for some kooky reason,
right?
I cannot understand, then they also decide, well, now we can add one more name after they had already done this. Which was whack, because the extra names that they got were people that were just coming out of left field that had none of this sort of consensus. I don't know why they did that. But in terms of Pete Kremen's name coming forward, he had not applied for the position. He was put forward by the new council member, Tyler Byrd. But I have to say this about Tyler. He did not sign on to the process that council had agreed to in December. He did not agree to that process. He was not on the council at the time. And in fact, you know, Tuesday night was his first time on the council. So now he's unrestrained on this, and the legal counsel for the county said, yeah, you can nominate anybody you want. So he put Pete's name forward. It's not an outrageous proposal because there were several former council people, both county council and
city
council.
True, but I need a kind of focus on the point that you slipped in there with a whole bunch of other things, that he had not applied.
He had not.
That is where people got upset. I don't think anybody questions his background, his experience. Some people have questioned where he resides most of the year, which a lot of people know is Mexico and what percentage of that. But I think some of the ire that I saw was that there were so many people who had applied, and a lot of women being very concerned that women had applied and that he brought forward a name of somebody who didn't. As to your question about whether or not he's willing, Barry Buchanan at the moment that Tyler Byrd recommended him or nominated him, Barry Buchanan said, is he willing? And Tyler said, yes, which implies that somebody had a conversation there.
But this whole process was such a disservice to the people who stood up. And, you know, we earlier in previously on Cascadia News Now, you know, I think I was very happy that so many people had stood up. And this is absurd that they allowed more names that hadn't applied. And it's like going, you, if somebody ran for office and you went through this whole ordeal of that, and then somebody who wasn't even filed won, it's crazy making that they did this.
I agree. I mean, I think it's extremely disrespectful to the people who took the time to apply that they didn't get any consideration at all, and then this name gets forwarded. But I will say this, that the legal counsel for the council, their legal consultant, Dan Gibson, cited the county code, Whatcom County Code, that basically says that they're not restricted to any sort of list. They can name who they want to. And so I think that they had to bow to the county code. They could not foreclose on somebody putting a name out that hadn't applied. But I do think that overall it's disrespectful to that. Yeah.
Right. You're both absolutely right on that. So where we're left is with eight nominees now. Tim Ballew, Seth Fleetwood, Natalie McClendon, Patricia Dunn, Alicia Rule, Cliff Langley, who we've heard from before, Pete Kremen, and Carol Frazee. They will allow those people or invite those people to speak from the floor at the next meeting and then have their final vote. And we are going to move on to our final topic of the night or the day, if you're listening in the daytime. We have heard a lot about net neutrality, and I know that Governor Inslee spoke to net neutrality, and one of the things that has been bandied about is the idea of public fiber optics. And Dave, do you want to set us up and tell us a little bit about this?
Sure. So most of the country is wired through twisted copper wire, and that's really good for some very limited applications. And most of what's out there was put at the was laid at the beginning of the 20th century, and there's been some upgrades and some improvements, but there's really been a push to spread fiber optic cable, which is fascinating. If you are interested even slightly in telecommunications or engineering or anything like that, look up fiber optic. It doesn't stop at any point. You can send light at different frequencies down it to send, you know, two messages at the same time. It's made through this just insane process, and it's fascinating and wonderful, and I like fiber optic a lot. We've spent a lot of money in this country, almost $500 billion, to wire everybody up with fiber optic. Most of that money went to telecom company shareholders, and we don't see very much of it. But some folks are looking to expand what we have already in the ground here in Bellingham and open that up for more use.
And one of the people that you may have heard from or heard of in our town is John Humphrey. He's sort of been a one-man band on the fiber optic issue and the public fiber optics issue for Bellingham, and has really been working hard to bring this to the forefront. And Dave had an opportunity to interview him recently.
You've been very active locally talking about municipal fiber and broadband. Can you get me up to speed on that?
Sure. We actually already in Bellingham own a publicly owned fiber optic network. The city uses it for its own purposes. What we're talking about is using that resource so that people can get better choices, especially net neutral choices, better speeds, and lower their cost.
So what would this look like? Is there a model city implementation that you're mm-hmm. basing this off of?
Yeah, well, our city very close to us, Mount Vernon, Washington, has a open access network, which is what we would want to base this off of. They have 9 providers on that network. There are also a lot of other cities that have been very successful. Santa Monica, California, Chattanooga, Tennessee, Fort Collins, Colorado has been in the news. Over 450 cities in the United States have successfully done this. And the San Juan Islands also have done this to some extent, and they are using it to help maintain net neutrality.
So not all cities have been successful. I mean, the most famous failure was Provo, Utah. Mm-hmm. What have you learned from looking at their experience?
It's important when we look at this to understand that this takes place over a long period of time. So we had a pilot project in Bellingham back in, I believe it was 2008, 2009, that part of it ended up being sold off. However, the necessity for broadband continues to grow, and especially with the loss of net neutrality, undermines our rights as American citizens. So there's a law called Nielsen's Law of Internet Bandwidth that says that the need for bandwidth grows 50% every 18 months. So our needs throughout all of this time, even with some of these failures, the needs have continued to grow. And we pay 10 times the rate in the United States for broadband they do in other developed countries, a gigabit, which is 1,000 megabits, both down and up. In Japan, for example, is $25 a month. In Kansas City is $70 a month. Here, you're lucky if you can get close to that for $2, $200 a month. And so, yeah, there have been a couple of failures, but on the whole, this has been very good for cities that have done it. It has definitely increased their local self-reliance, which is something we have to ask ourselves about, too. What if, you know, worst case scenario, the economy collapsed or something like that? How would we still do communications? Right now, our infrastructure in Bellingham is very poor. We rely on a lot of private companies to provide these services. And yes, they have contracts. They're not supposed to go anywhere if something happens. But how many of us really believe that these companies will honor those contracts if, you know, we got into a worst case scenario? What we want to do is get to providers that live in the community and care about it. And some of those providers have already committed to net neutrality. PogoZone, for example, is staying committed to net neutrality. And they provide a lot of point-to-point wireless up here, but they provide tons of fiber down in fiber access down in Mount Vernon. And that fiber, of course, is owned publicly. We have HamsterNet ISP Co-op looking to get started, and they have pre-committed to net neutrality.
What is your kind of vision for the technology? Because, you know, it comes in a lot of different forms. There's fiber to point and then wireless. There's fiber to the home.
No matter what broadband solution you go with, you have to back it up with fiber. This is one of these things that's in debate right now. 5G wireless, they don't expect a full standard for that to be out until 2022. To really do 5G wireless correctly, you need to put small cells at pretty much every street corner. Those small cells have to be hooked up to fiber. The bandwidth from the macro tower to these small cells, a lot of times you have to reserve bandwidth for the small cells so they don't interfere with each other. The bandwidth for fiber, which has no problems with interference or these other issues, is starting to be referred to as unlimited by a lot of reporters because the technology just keeps developing so fast. So the truth is that fiber and really any other broadband technology are complementary. They're not at odds with each other. So we need to understand that we need to have fiber and we need to have as much of it as we can. The best way to do it would be to establish a dig once policy.
Can you expand on that a little?
A dig once policy, Mount Vernon has given us their documentation for it, and that's what I've suggested we follow with a couple of modifications. I think we should be doing 3x3, which is 2 3-inch pipes for our conduit installations. Basically, it says that whenever we dig up a road, when developers are building new communities, et cetera, they'll just start to put in conduit by default. And the conduit is not very expensive. And that would it would be smart for them to also put in conduit and fiber, but we definitely need the conduit. Once the conduit's in place, co-ops, other private providers can start using the conduit to run fiber through, to hook up to wireless devices if they want to or whatever. But it starts by having conduit. It also starts by getting access to the resources we already have. Because again, the city already has a fiber network that providers have asked for access to, and they've refused them access to it. Not necessarily with, or I shouldn't say necessarily, not with very good excuses.
Would this be a project run by the city? Would this be a public-private partnership?
Well, in the state of Washington, we have some strange laws. Doing direct municipal fiber to a residence or a business is not something you could do in the state of Washington. I would like to see that, and Senator Rolfes in District 27 keeps putting out legislation to make that possible. In the meantime, what we want is an open access network like they have in Mount Vernon, which basically the public owns the fiber. The city, you know, is involved in managing it to some extent. But most of the heavy lifting is done by the providers and co-ops on that network, including tech support calls, including maintenance. So it's really actually very low risk for the city to do. They're not going to be really heavily involved initially with installations, which they already do anyway. But the grand majority of the work is going to be done by the providers and co-ops.
So you mentioned the poor state of our existing communications infrastructure. Mm-hmm. That poor state extends also to the rest of our infrastructure. Mm-hmm. What makes this a priority now over repairing bridges and roads?
Because this should be done – well, one, it's a priority because Bellingham has 6% perpetual unemployment. A third of the people in Bellingham earn $25,000. That includes some families. $25,000 or less a year. We need the jobs and educational opportunities, next generation jobs that come with a technological infrastructure like this. This would be done in concert with other infrastructure improvements that we need to be doing. And again, is not the most expensive thing that is done when any of these improvements are done. So it's really always been a priority. It's something we should have been doing over the last few decades, and unfortunately haven't. But we need to get on this bandwagon, or we are not going to have the resources we need to compete. Our neighbor to the north, Canada, has guaranteed a 50 megabits down, 10 up connection, which is what we pay, I think, around $60 a month to Comcast for, right, as a basic right to their citizens. We aren't even close to that, right? And they're essentially an economic competitor to us, especially with our geographical location. So we don't want to get marooned with the San Juans doing it, with Mount Vernon doing it, with Canada doing it. We're basically surrounded by communities that are doing this.
Can you go into a little bit more what you're talking about with those up and down?
Sure. So what we're talking about is the amount of data that you move in a second. So 50 megabits down and 10 up is the connection that most people have at home. In Japan, for $25 a month, you would get 1,000 megabits down and 1,000 megabits up.
It seems like policies like that build conduits when you're building a road, mm-hmm. and things like that. That seems fairly straightforward. Why isn't that happening already?
I've met with city officials about this, including the Public Works Director, Ted Carlson. He says that it is done when practical. So they haven't started installing a little bit of 2x2 conduit for themselves, but again, they refuse the public access to it.
And 2x2 conduit is?
2 inch by 2 inch. And so when practical, that's not a commitment to anything. They determine when practical is. We need an overlying dig once policy that will basically just guarantee that we start putting this critical infrastructure in whenever we do a repair. Right now, you can imagine a situation where, you know, they'll put down all the asphalt and all the concrete and everything and then be like, oh, well, we should have also done this. Well, then you have to tear the road back up again. So you want to make sure that you're saving the most money as well in the first place and just putting this stuff in up front whenever you do any repair. We have to start to think of infrastructure in 60 to 100-year terms, which, by the way, fiber's super durable and has no problems with electromagnetic interference or any problems that other technologies have, and it lasts 60 to 100 years. So we want to, again, be putting in conduit and fiber whenever we can.
Since the early 90s, nationally, we have spent in the neighborhood of $500 billion to telecommunications companies to expand broadband access mm-hmm. across the country. And we have seen for that very little. And so I'm a little uncomfortable when we start talking about spending more. How are we going to make sure that this project has accountability and we're actually getting what we're paying for?
And that's a really good point. There was an article released recently. Yeah, we gave $400 billion to the big telecom companies, and they mostly ran away with it. We gave so much money to them that every American should already have a fiber to the home connection. The historical reference I can think of is the Transcontinental Railroad, where the railroad builders thought Lincoln would be so involved in the Civil War, he wouldn't be able to chase them down. And so they put him about a mile of track, and then they stopped and ran away with the money. And he did stop and hold them accountable. So we need to have people in government that are excited about helping their communities and will hold the telecoms accountable instead of rolling out the red carpet for them and letting them do whatever they want, which is the situation that we're in. And we also need to find out where this money went. It blows my mind that, you know, this current administration in November, they did 8 creepy things as well as get rid of net neutrality the next month. One of those things they said was reasonable copper to fiber upgrades. So what they're planning on doing is just giving the same amount of money to the telecoms again that already stole it and ran away with it. And so we need to build public networks where we know exactly what's going in and our government can hold the installers accountable. But we also need to have people in key positions that will hold them accountable. So we need to hold our government accountable. We need people in government that will hold others accountable. And we need to stop making contracts with telecoms that, let's be honest, Comcast, CenturyLink, Verizon, AT&T, we let them get away with charging us 10 times as much as every other developed country, and they turned around and paid us for our loyalty by attacking our First Amendment rights via taking away net neutrality. So we need to stop doing business with these companies.
So if people are looking to get more information about what you're doing and how to get involved, what can they do?
They should go to change.org, and in the upper right-hand corner, search for Bellingham Public Fiber. I'm available to speak at events. I just spoke at the Bellingham Linux Users Group on January 4th. I'm happy to speak to neighborhood associations. And they should check out sites like Community Broadband Networks, talk to Christopher Mitchell, Community Broadband Networks, and check and see what Mount Vernon is doing. There's tons of information out there about communities that have done this successfully, and it's more important now than ever.
Well, thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
That was John Humphrey speaking with Dave Willingham about fiber optics, public fiber optics in Bellingham. John Humphrey does have a petition on change.org, and we will get that link up on our Facebook page, Cascadia News Now, and also on our website, CascadiaNewsNow.com, which is conveniently where you can also find past shows and other interviews. But if you only remember one link tonight, please make that link be SaveKMRE.org. We are over the two-thirds hump, and radio may be saved in Whatcom County, and we would love to have just a couple of dollars from you if you believe in the show. If the show and local voices, local arts is important to you, please go to SaveKMRE.org. That is our show, Cascadia News Now, produced by me, Stephanie Contours. Technical director, Dave Willingham. Our engineer, the fantastic Devlin Sweeney. And thanks to guests Barbara Rothgar and John Humphrey. Our co-host, Dave Willingham, and the fantastic I Know Everything, Tim Johnson. Tune in next week. You're listening to Cascadia News Now on KAVZ 102.5 in Deming, Van Zandt, and KMRE 102.3 FM, Bellingham.